It is Tuesday, October 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo meets with top Saudi officials in Riyadh, but no further information about a missing Saudi journalist is released. The Florida Panhandle copes with the devastation caused by Hurricane Michael.
The damage is really catastrophic.
And participants mark the 50th anniversary of the iconic Black Power salute at the 1968 Summer Olympics. It's all ahead. On Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Saudi Arabia's King Salman and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman concerning the missing Saudi journalist last seen 2 weeks ago entering Riyadh's consulate in Istanbul. However, there was no immediate information on his fate. The U.S. State Department said that the country's top diplomat made it clear to the Saudis that learning what happened to Jamal Khashoggi is the primary reason President Donald Trump dispatched him to Riyadh, and the matter is of great interest to the president. The Saudis have rejected Turkish claims that Saudi agents murdered Khashoggi inside the consulate October 2nd, but the State Department did not say what the monarch and the heir to the throne told Pompeo. The State Department said Pompeo told the Saudi leaders of the importance of conducting a thorough, transparent, and timely investigation and welcomed Riyadh's support for Turkish investigators in their probe. U.S. news reports said Saudi Arabia was edging toward acknowledging that Khashoggi was killed after he entered the consulate, blaming his death on an interrogation gone wrong. Khashoggi, a critic of the Crown Prince in columns written for the Washington Post, had been living in the U.S. in self-imposed exile. David Mack is a scholar at the Middle East Institute. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it's easier to pass the blame on anything that goes wrong on lower-level operatives.
This is the sort of thing that it would be very hard to get away with in the U.S. system. In Saudi Arabia, it's obviously easier with a controlled press, with a great degree of discipline that the ruling family is able to exercise. So it's, I suppose, possible that Saudi Arabia will be able to sell this. However, I think most people would be very dubious that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had not had some hand in the matter or knowledge that it was taking place.
The president has dispatched Secretary of State Pompeo to meet King Salman over the matter. What do you think he might accomplish in that meeting?
Well, I would hope this is a sign that the president is distancing himself from his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as being a key player in dealing with our relationship with Saudi Arabia and some other Middle East issues. The president tends to over-identify his personal fortunes and the fortunes of his family with the national interests of the United States. And Jared Kushner has demonstrated what was predictable, a person with limited experience, limited knowledge about the region. And I would suggest also a high degree of naivete in his dealings with Middle East officials from several governments, not just Saudi Arabia. So I'm glad to see the president turning to Secretary of State Pompeo. Among other things, Pompeo has a lot of personal experience, good national security credentials, but he also has some senior diplomats in the State Department who are very experienced about Saudi matters and can advise him. And he can also get assistance from General Mattis and the career people in the Department of Defense.
Back to Jared Kushner for a minute. I saw one commentary that suggested this could set back this long-anticipated Mideast peace plan that apparently involves Saudi Arabia.
Well, most of us who followed this don't really believe that there's much in the way of a credible peace plan. We would all dearly love to see a peace plan that would bring about a real and lasting peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. However, it's looked increasingly as if Jared Kushner and the other people who are involved in trying to put this together among the limited circle that works for Trump on this issue, the idea was basically that they were going to try to buy off the Palestinians and provide them with enough money and wealth to get them to accept giving up a lot of their political claims and aspirations, and that the bill would be paid by countries like Saudi Arabia.
Other countries, of course, have been accused of political assassination. I think of Russia and North Korea as two examples. What might this do, if in fact this is what it turned out to be, to U.S.-Saudi relations?
I think it will be a setback, but it's not going to mean the end of rather close and important strategic relationships between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia.
David Mack said the U.S. and the Saudi kingdom maintain relations on a number of levels, ranging from arms sales, energy security, and combating terrorist groups, as well as countering Iran's actions. He said just as relations were repaired following the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, so they will be in this case. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. A U.S. general says the fight to defeat the Islamic State is facing the danger of complacency. President Donald Trump threatens to cut aid to Honduras if a migrant caravan isn't stopped. President Trump blasts Senator Elizabeth Warren over her Native American claims. And China says Muslim ethnic minorities are in internment camps for free vocational training. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Hubble Space Telescope and Chandra X-ray Observatory recently experienced problems that forced them out of commission. Engineers and technicians at the space agency were successful in diagnosing problems with one of Chandra's gyroscopes. They say after applying a series of software patches, the X-ray telescope should resume normal operations. But so far, NASA hasn't had the same success with the Hubble Space Telescope, which was the first to go out of service, also due to problems with a gyroscope. Hubble mission technicians and engineers continue their work so that the space telescope also can resume normal science operations. The mission for NASA's planet-hunting Kepler spacecraft had to be modified after its gyroscope-like reaction wheels malfunctioned in 2012. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a blind athlete achieves her dream of hiking the Grand Canyon. Residents of the Florida Panhandle are continuing to deal with the devastation caused by Hurricane Michael. The huge storm came ashore last week as a powerful hurricane with maximum winds of 250 kilometers per hour and a high storm surge. It combined to knock down buildings, cut off electricity, and leave debris strewn across coastal areas. At least 19 deaths have been blamed on the storm along its path from Florida to Virginia. Among the hardest hit areas was Mexico Beach, a town that Florida Governor Rick Scott said now resembles a war zone. Vicki Eichstadt is a national spokesperson for the American Red Cross and is currently in Tallahassee. She has toured the hardest hit areas and describes to me what she has seen.
The pictures you see on TV really don't do it justice. The damage is really catastrophic. Lots of total destruction of homes, businesses, roads closed and blocked by downed trees and other building debris. Power is slowly being restored. It's been very gratifying to see huge convoys of utility trucks on the highway coming to the affected areas from all over the country to help. So that's been gratifying, but it takes a long time for that much power to be restored.
And what about cell phone and phone coverage?
It's still very spotty. There are some carriers that work better in other places, and even those are in and out. So it's communication and using technology is a challenge.
I believe the latest figures that at least 19 people have died in this hurricane, but I believe that there's still a number of people that are still missing.
I can't speak to that in particularly, Sarah. What I can tell you is that last night, more than 1,600 people stayed in 21 shelters across Florida and Georgia.
Wow, that is amazing. So what are conditions like for them? Are you able to give them the supplies, the things like food and other supplies that they need?
Yes, we have worked diligently here on the ground in Florida to bring in needed supplies, cots, blankets. Also, there are more than 1,500 Red Cross workers on the ground doing care for shelter residents, working with them to provide basic health and disaster mental health, spiritual care workers, people who are feeding hot meals, people who are driving emergency response vehicles to deliver food to shelters from mobile kitchens, and also traveling to affected areas when it is safe to do so.
Yeah, I've seen and heard interviews with people affected by the storm. Their homes are completely gone. Some of them don't even have, you know, money on them, wallets. They really have nothing. Some of these people, what can be done for them? I mean, because they can really only probably stay at the shelter for a limited amount of time.
Well, the Red Cross will be here as long as we're needed, as long as there are people who don't have a next place to go, will be here. We have caseworkers that will be working in the shelters to help people figure out what their next steps are, to help them understand what other resources are available to them as they begin to move forward. We're a little way from that yet. We're still in the emergency phase, but that will happen.
And I have read about a number of people, patients at the hospital in Panama City had to be evacuated, had to move to other areas. People that have medical situations, certainly that's got to be ongoing.
We do have health workers in all of our shelters who help people get replacement medications, who can help them replace durable medical equipment. So we have really a good setup for that, and we urge people who have those kinds of needs to come to the shelter and make sure that they're working with a health professional to get those things that they need.
Okay, is there anything else that you would like to say that perhaps I haven't asked you about?
Well, I think the important thing to note is that this is an absolutely catastrophic disaster. This is the largest hurricane to make landfall in Florida in decades. Conditions are challenging, but they're getting better every day. The Red Cross is working with all of its government, state, county, and local partners to provide as much help as we can, just as quickly as we can. The fact that we were able to respond within a very few hours after the hurricane hit goes to the generosity of the American people, who donate to the American Red Cross and make it so that that disaster assistance is ready and waiting.
Vicki Eichstadt, National Spokesperson for the American Red Cross. She was speaking with me from Tallahassee. 3 weeks before a crucial U.S. midterm election, it would be difficult to find much that Democrats and Republicans agree on. But one thing both parties do agree with is the notion that President Donald Trump will be the key issue in elections that will determine control of Congress for the next 2 years. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the Trump factor in the 2018 elections from Washington.
For President Donald Trump, this year's midterm elections are personal.
All of this extraordinary progress is at stake. It is at stake. I'm not on the ballot, but in a certain way, I'm on the ballot, so please go out and vote. Go out and vote.
But as much as Trump motivates his core supporters, he also energizes critics like Jenny Hines.
There's an active resistance to this president who is operating as if he is above the law.
Does anybody have any questions?
Trump is the central figure in this year's election, says American University analyst David Barker.
Yes, Democrats from, you know, the day after the election in 2016 have been waiting for this day, and it's all about Trump. Trump fully embraces that. He wants it to be all about him.
Kanye's been a friend of mine for a long time.
Trump has accelerated a trend to nationalize congressional elections, says Laura Brown.
It really is now all national, and everyone is kind of looking at this as either a referendum for or against the president and his party.
For Trump and his base, it makes sense, says former Trump strategist Steve Bannon.
I think if you make this a national referendum and nationalize this election on the success of President Trump's program, it's a clear winner. And I think the Democrats get crushed.
But others are skeptical, including former Republican National Chairman Michael Steele.
All right, fine. You want it to be about you? Well, every candidate on the ballot now has to account for your behavior, has to account for your tweets.
Get out and vote. Thank you.
Trump is likely to generate higher Democratic turnout, says Maryland Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger.
When all you do is care about yourself and not about people, and not about people, what they need, not about your seniors needing medical care, and you just want to look good and knock them out, which is happening. This is hurting, and this is why I think a lot of people will come out.
We are going to fight, and we are going to win, win, win.
But the president does not seem to be worried, preferring instead to rally his own supporters, says Gallup pollster Frank Newport.
He's kind of given up on attempting to broaden his appeal, it looks like. It fits more with his style. He has a very, as we all know, a very combative style. He likes to have enemies because that gives him somebody to fight against. So it would be hard for a president like Trump anyhow to probably try to broaden his appeal.
Donald Trump's name will not appear on the November 6th election ballots, but the results could determine the future of his presidency. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Blind Paralympic cyclist Shawn Cheshire recently faced her biggest challenge, a rim-to-rim hike through the Grand Canyon. She and her fellow hikers spoke with VOA's Mike O'Sullivan about the experience.
68 kilometers of steep and uneven terrain, hiking through the night from rim to rim and back, finishing in just over 24 hours.
Sometimes in periods of the last couple of years, I've been on this desperate purpose of grasping as much independence as possible. And so for me, you know, being able to walk in the Grand Canyon like that, that's freedom.
Cheshire, who lost her sight after an accident 9 years ago, competed in cycling in the Paralympics in Rio and hopes to compete in Tokyo in 2020. She's training toward that goal. In the meantime, she was determined to finish this challenging hike.
I had a huge ball of emotion welled up in my chest. Like, I cannot believe we just did that. And just gratitude, just felt very humbled and very grateful.
Three friends helped her complete the trek, serving as guides and warning of obstacles. It appears that she broke a Grand Canyon record for a blind hiker.
We literally smashed it, and including going up the North Rim and down the North Rim, the entire thing, every trail that we were on, I've never actually gone that fast on.
It was an exercise in teamwork.
I've learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot more about the canyon.
For Shawn Cheshire, it was another accomplishment on the road to many others. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong.
You love music?
How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. It's the 50th anniversary of the iconic moment when two African-American Olympic athletes raised their fists in defiance to bring attention to racial oppression in the U.S. It happened at their medal ceremony at the 1968 Summer Olympics. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo examines the significance of the moment in history.
October 16th, 1968, with the world watching, U.S. Olympic runners Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fist into the air to protest inequity against African Americans. The historic moment unfolded on the medal stand at the Mexico City Olympics, a period of tremendous strife in America.
It was occurring at a time in which there's a great deal of tension and a great deal of uncertainty about how to conduct ourselves in the same summer following the assassination of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Senator Bobby Kennedy.
Smith capturing the gold medal had just broken the world record in the 200-meter race. Carlos won the bronze. At the medal stand, the pair stood shoeless to symbolize poverty and wore beads to represent lynching victims. As the Star-Spangled Banner played, they bowed their heads and raised their fist in protest. American University race, media, and communication professor Sherry Williams says it was an act of courage and bravery.
So to have these two young black men take this moment that was really amplified across the globe and particularly here in this country and to use it to bring attention to the black liberation struggle was very, very significant.
After the 1968 medal ceremony, the U.S. Olympic team suspended the men and sent them home. But at a recent event in Washington, D.C., the pair was hailed as heroes.
Free expressions must be a continuous sound, my people, through education, because overcoming is not a dead issue. In the face of adversity, the struggle continues.
In September, Carlos returned to Mexico City to mark the anniversary of the defiant moment 50 years ago. He used the occasion to remind others that every person can make a difference.
Doing the right thing is not an easy thing to do for me or anyone else. I stood there 50 years ago in the podium where one guy had his fist up with me and another guy stood there in support of me. But 50 years of that poster being there, we three cannot change society to make it better without the help of you.
Inevitably, there are modern-day comparisons to the current U.S. controversy over NFL players kneeling during the national anthem and other protests against police brutality. The Mexico City moment is considered an inspiration.
Right now, in 2018, 50 years old, there are still individuals who sort of are protest-oriented, who look to that time for clues on how to conduct themselves now. And that just speaks to the lasting power of that moment.
We see that when athletes do stand up and step up, that it really does make a difference and it causes systemic change. And that's what Tommy Smith and John Carlos were trying to do in 1968. That's what Colin Kaepernick is trying to do today.
With their common bond of breaking barriers, Smith and Kaepernick made it a point to meet in person last fall. Two men who put fighting racial injustice ahead of their own athletic careers. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
That is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.